Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
It's the top news stories of 2015, guest edition. This week, Black Lives Matter, China's one-child policy, the price of oil, militarization of the police, and much, much more. Let's begin episode 325.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome, tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. Last couple of weeks, we talked about the top science stories of 2015. This week, we're going to talk about the top news stories of the year. Basically, anything but science. Returning this week is Gulid. Say hello, Gulid.
Hello, folks. Glad to be with you.
And Nicholas has joined us yet again. Say hi, Nicholas.
Hey, guys. It's my pleasure to be on the show again.
And joining us is Matt. Say hi, Matt.
Hi, Matt.
Okay. So, Gulid, what are your top three stories of 2015? Start us off. What is the biggest story you think of last year?
Well, one of them is the large, massive numbers of indigenous women being missing and murdered in the past few years. And it looks like the Canadian RCMP and federal government are putting more resources into investigating the matter.
I know one of the things that I had heard about this was, I mean, one, the Harper government, which is no longer in power, basically didn't think there was a problem that, quote unquote, if you're doing an act of social science by saying that these indigenous women are somehow different than any other women who were killed in the year. But it seems to have been a reawakening that this really is an issue. So what is the underlying thing? Why are indigenous women seem to be seen as more vulnerable than, let's say, anyone else who happens to be walking the street?
Well, there's the overt racism, you know, against the indigenous people in general. There's the fact that a lot of them live in poverty in lower socioeconomic situations. So I think that does come into play.
I think I played a bit of an unintentional pun, because walking the street is another thing that actually comes into it. Because of the socioeconomic status of indigenous women, that a lot of them do turn to the sex trade as a means of survival. And you get that, oh yes, it's just another hooker dead, who cares, sort of attitude from the quote establishment. And I think that played a lot into it as well.
It does. And you know, even then, they are still citizens, still Canadians, still human beings, and should definitely not go unaccounted for their lives in general.
I think an interesting tie-in as well with the Black Lives Matter, which we'll go into as another thing I think that you're interested in, if I may preface this, is the idea that you also get a lot of domestic violence. And as you mentioned, with the racism that is endemic or systemic to our society, that, you know, again, these are people who are marginalized. They experience violence more often. You have the whole residential school debacle playing into that. So that, you know, treating the death of indigenous women specifically as just a woman's death ignores all this baggage that comes along with it.
Yep, that's very true. And actually, related to the indigenous woman, one of the cases that I read as an example was the Robert Picton situation, where he was charged with murdering multiple women around the Vancouver downtown east side, a lot of them being prostitutes. And during the early portion of his murderings, there was a lot of calls towards the police about, you know, Aboriginal families calling about, you know, their daughters being missing, and not a lot was really done. And had that been treated with more seriousness, it could have potentially have saved lives.
I think one of the things that plays into that, and I think we'll roll up with the second half of what you were talking about, is the whole idea in the United States, you have this big movement of Black Lives Matter. And it's not so much that they're saying that Black Lives Matter more than anyone else, but Black lives should matter as much as everyone else. And you get that here in Canada, whereas, and again, I'm white-splaining to you, Gulid, who actually should be talking about this more than I, that in Canada, we don't have the same issue, although we do have issues, with people of color so much as we do with our natives. Our natives here are what the blacks are in the United States. And in that same sense, that Indigenous lives matter, or in this particular case, Indigenous women's lives matter, seems to be a clarion call that is being said here, if not using those wordings.
Yep, that's very true. So it says here that Aboriginal or Indigenous women have a homicide rate of roughly 4.5 times higher than that of all other women in Canada. So this is a glaring example of how more resources need to be put into finding the missing women and investigating the murdered women.
So how does that relate into the Black Lives Matter thing? Because that was another topic I had you on the show and we talked about.
I'm glad you asked, because in 2015, Daniel Holtzclaw, who was a 29-year-old police officer in Oklahoma City, just got charged with 36 counts of rape and found guilty of 18, and is now dealing with a sentence of life in prison. And his crime was raping and sexually assaulting, I believe it's 13 women. And a lot of these women were, a majority of these women actually were African-American. And personally, I believe one of the reasons he was able to get away with it for so long was the fact that they were African-American women. Granted, they are poor, lower on the socioeconomic scale, and a few of them were actually involved in sexual soliciting, prostitution. But at the same time, this case, what he's been doing, has been going on for a long time.
I think one of the things that played into this as well, and it shows the sort of systemic, what's the word? Again, racism is the only word, although there's a better word, I think, for it, is that he knew he could prey upon women of color. As you say, I thought they were all women of color, but let's say the majority, because he knew that even if they did complain, no one would believe them. And I think that helped him a lot in him sort of, well, at least believing he can get away with it, and obviously to a large degree getting away with it. In fact, I understand it was one woman, she was about 55 years old when she was attacked by this one, who basically said, no, you can't do that. And she was sort of the spearhead of this, well, let's call for justice. And justice was eventually done. I'm kind of curious, Matt, what do you think of the whole Indigenous women / Black Lives Matters issue that became such a big thing this year?
I mean, for me, the Black Lives Matter thing, it's hard to say it came out of nowhere, but in the news for me, it came out of nowhere. I guess I wasn't following it as closely as some others people might have, but I was surprised by it. I mean, I'm not, in terms of the amount of violence they were purportedly doing themselves. So like where they were going through the colleges and berating other students of different ethnicities and different colors. I think that is what surprised me about it, not the movement itself. So that would be in terms of Black Lives Matter. I think that would be that, because you think that maybe the anger and the overt kind of nature of that movement, that might be how they're trying to get the attention, because maybe, you know, they weren't getting attention in another way.
Well, I think it's also interesting how, again, it has shed a lot of light on, I mean, you mentioned some things about college, but I mean, one of the big things, again, why Black Lives Matter comes from is the death of people like Freddie Gray and all that. I mean, we've all probably seen the video of I can't remember his name, but the guy who was selling cigarettes in New York.
Oh, yeah.
Literally choked to death in front of our eyes. You know, how many police videos have we seen of a black man running away and being shot in the back as he's going away? And then it turns out that the cop said that he was attacking me when it, no, that was not true. You lied. Nicholas, you have any thoughts on the topic?
I think both of these topics, those two top, I think both of these two topics tie back to, you know, social stereotype and racism, all because, you know, indigenous women are different and black women are different. That's why they're not treated as equally as, that's not the, that's why they're not given as much attention as other type of people. But I'm just interesting back in Canada, in Vancouver at least, this year we also see, you know, a few white Caucasian union start coming out. One of the famous one is the UBC White Student Union, which pretty much is a union for all European Caucasian students. And they claim that white people are not getting as much attention as colored people. So that's one of the interesting topics that came out this year as well.
Well, you know, I think it's somehow it's fascinating you bring that up, because one of the things that is hard for people like me and to out you, Matt, is the concept of white privilege, is that in a very realistic degree, there is a lot of discrimination that goes against, quote, white people, male people. There's a lot of cis normal people. There's a lot of classifications you can fall into that. And it's not discrimination in the sense that you would have got against people of color or women or that sort of thing, where you're trying to keep them down. But in order to raise everyone up to the level that I enjoy as a white male in our society, just by virtue of being a white male, means that, you know, an employer will look at me and says, okay, Gulit is a person of color, we should give him slightly more preferential treatment simply because of his skin color. And we live in a, if I may generously say, a recovering racist state, that his preference is my disadvantage, that I am being discriminated against, but not to lower me, but to raise everyone else up to the standards that I enjoy now. Matt, as a person who experiences privilege every day in your life, whether you want it or know it or not, do you see what I mean, or do you disagree?
I mean, I think I'm naive and I disagree, but I also think you're right. I think I choose to believe that there is no difference. I choose to believe that we're all treated the same and we all get the same treatment. But I think in certain circumstances it's not true, because of who is doing, in your example, who's doing the hiring or who's doing the leading or who's doing the
actually, the Matt, so around. So one, there's been a number of studies done that show that if you take two resumes and you put a, and this is mainly the States, but I'm sure, again, if you did First Nations people, you'd get the same result here, that if you put a black-sounding name on the resume versus a Caucasian-sounding name, that the Caucasian will be called up for an interview significantly more than the one with black-sounding name.
And I absolutely agree with that. I'm just saying that I choose the ignorance.
Have you ever done Project Implicit?
No.
You should, because that shows that even that there is no choice in it. But I will I will accept your willingness to be a better person, and let us move on. So Gulid, what is your second top story of 2015?
Well, similar to the last episode, I also wanted to speak on the Syrian refugees. We have been getting them in, and we have recently had an incident where a Syrian refugee was pepper sprayed in Vancouver at his welcome ceremony.
Several, I think.
Several. Newly arrived government-sponsored refugees sprayed by a man on a bicycle.
That seems horrific, but isn't it true that these Syrian refugees are also terrorists?
I don't think that's true. but, Prime Minister Trudeau spoke out about it, saying that that in no way, shape, or form represents Canadian values. And all in all, it didn't look like there was any ill will from the incident. I believe one of the refugees said that he still loves Canada and loves being in Canada.
I think one of the things that plays into this too, especially with the narrative, I do believe the premier of Saskatchewan said that, oh yes, we shouldn't let them in because they're a security risk or whatever, really don't understand how the refugee process goes. I mean, it's very different than what you see in Europe, where you do to a certain degree have hordes of people crossing the border willy-nilly without too much control over who actually comes through. But to become a refugee here in Canada, one, we have this ocean. So you're not getting here unless we want you to be here. And most refugee claims take several years in order to happen. And the vast majority, well, at least the vast majority up to now, are you need some form of sponsorship here in Canada. So these are people who are not only vetted, but they also have someone who will sort of stand up for them. So the idea that, you know, that as some fear-mongering proto-fascist in the States might say that we should stop all of them coming over here because they might be a terrorist threat, one, ignores the fact that far more people are killed by horses each year than have ever been killed by terrorists in this nation. And the whole idea of Canada as a good nation is that if you are in need, if you need help, we are a caring nation. Nicholas, what do you think about the whole Syrian refugee? And maybe I'll give you a spin. The fact that Trudeau, oh my God, isn't living up to his election promising, and he didn't get 25,000 people there. How horrific is that?
I think the Syrian refugee wouldn't be a threat to the safety of Canada. I think because of the good gesture, we're showing the world how acceptable we are. And that even for the Muslim countries to see that as well. Seeing Canada as a welcoming country, I think that will actually reduce the risk of Canada getting attacked because of the friendliness of our country.
And Matt,
are we still talking about that? It's crazy that we didn't hit 25,000.
Because I was being a little sarcastic on that.
Yeah, I know, right? I welcome it. I think it's great. We are a multicultural nation, and adding to it is great. And there's a lot of research that suggests that, you know, government-sanctioned refugees are actually more contributing to an economy than a lot of home-born citizens because they don't want to step out of line and get sent home to this horrible situation that they're from. So, you know, I hear a lot of, you know, oh, we had to push that 25,000 back to February, and that's okay. But I'm excited to see what happens.
I think one of the ways that we can take a good thing from a bad thing is, okay, we had this one horrible person who pepper sprayed a bunch of the Syrian refugees, but the almost universal, wholehearted, communal backlash against that, the, oh my God, this isn't us, we're so sorry, basically showed that, you know, yes, in every nation, in every way, there are going to be small setbacks, but it's seeing these setbacks and pushing back against it that we actually exhibit the greatness that is this country. And the greater its diversity, the greater it becomes, I think.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons some people might feel a little bit resentment to the Syrian refugees is because of how much the Canadian government is spending on the refugees. And then they feel like it's not fair for, it's not good for the government to spend the money on the refugees instead of spending the money on, you know, infrastructure and stuff like that. I think there's a breakdown of how much a refugee will cost, a daily cost. It turns out some of the daily cost is higher than, you know, a retired Canadian citizen. And so that may be one of the reasons why a lot of people feel a little bit resentment towards the refugees.
You know, and that is a good point, because there is sort of a short-term and a long-term aspect to this. Because it is true, when refugees first come to a nation, they are expensive. But most studies, as Matt, I think, referred to, when you look at the, you know, 20-year or 30-year investment, or if you go for the multi-generational investment, it actually turns out to be a big dividend, that they are a big plus to both the government via taxes and to society via just the dynamics that they add to the economy. But you are right. A lot of people see that through the lens. Shouldn't we be spending our money on us? And that goes into something we talked about in the last show over space exploration, whereas, yes, on the one hand, maybe we shouldn't be sending a rocket to Mars, but on the other hand, doing so makes us a much bigger people. There's so much more to us. So that's just my opinion. I put it out there. So, Gulid, what is your final top story of 2015?
I'm glad you asked, Don. For my final topic, I'm going to be looking at militarization, or militarization of the police. Now, in my opinion, police are the people and people are the police. Police play a significant role in the community in maintaining peace and preventing crime. But lately, what we've seen is that the culture of police departments is to respond almost military-like and respond aggressively. We've seen in the cases in Ferguson, New York, Cleveland, and Baltimore with Mike Brown, Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, Freddie Gray, where we've seen protests in response to those high-profile incidents. And whether peaceful or not peaceful, the police have sort of responded almost military-like, you know, wearing full body armor and shields. And it almost seems like the police are sort of separating or becoming separate from the community role that they're playing. And I think it's a big problem. I wanted to know what you guys thought.
I know one of the things that I remember starkly, especially from Ferguson, was a military armored military vehicle with a sniper on the roof looking over the crowd. I'm going, WTF? I mean, what the hell were they thinking about? I mean, it is the disconnect between, as you say, the peace officer who's supposed to keep the peace versus law enforcement officer, which has been a big change. And you get that here in Canada, not quite as bad. I mean, the Americans tend to do things that we imitate up here about 10 or 20 years later. But in the United States, you had an aggressive effort that actually started under Reagan with the militarization of officers in the war on drugs. And then, of course, after 9/11, all the stops were let out. And it's weird because, I mean, honestly, what good would it be for the Vancouver Police Department to have a tank, right? I don't think they have a tank, but if you go to the States, there are a number of cities, and not necessarily big cities, that have tanks and the like. And just under what circumstances would that possibly be useful? And part of it, of course, is you have the military-industrial complex, which means that the tank manufacturer makes lots of money by making sure everyone has these weapons. But you get that disconnect where, you know, I mean, cops are people too. And if you put them in a jazzy tank, they're going to want to blow their, you know what I'm saying. But in Canada, we had the G20 where we had a tremendous, what I think, overreach of the militarization of police, the appearance that the common person was somehow the enemy. I think Obama said it great that when he looked at, I think it was Ferguson, he didn't see a police force, but an occupation force. What do you think about that, Matt?
Yeah, it's hard because I think we all have the exact same opinion and how ridiculous it is. And I actually think that some police stations are actually being given tanks because there's too many to go around. If I'm not mistaken, I have to look that up again. But I also find it funny that they were essentially just using a tank as a prop-up station because, honestly, when are they going to use a tank? And it's just, for me, a waste of resources that can be used in other places. But I think we shouldn't be surprised when the United States spends so much on their military and so much on machismo. So I think it's just not anything that surprises me, although I hate it so much.
So Nicholas, I'm gonna twist the question for you just a little bit. One of the things that Guladori mentioned is sort of the Black Lives Matter, and where it seems that the mental state of the cop is kill first, ask questions later, which is, again, if you're sort of a soldier in a battle against evil, that might be a valid thing. But I would think that a peace officer's idea is that, okay, I'm going to put my life at risk so that the community can be as peaceful as possible. And that might mean I take a bullet every now and then, but if it saves an innocent person's life more times than not, that's a valid trade-off. What do you think of this whole idea that cops no longer see themselves, as they say, as peace officers, but as law enforcement agency, that the people are somehow the enemy?
I think that definitely defeats the purpose of a police. You know, there's a huge difference between domestic violence versus international dispute. I believe police, you know, for police, their first priority should be protecting the people and serve the citizens of the country. But I believe that after American Civil War, the American government banned the militarization of the police. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Posse Comitatus.
Sorry?
It's called Posse Comitatus. It's where the army was no longer allowed to be a police force.
Oh yes, that's what I meant. But I can definitely see the reason why the police force are getting more and more militarized. Because the domestic violence is starting to increase, especially with the threat of terrorism on U.S. soil. So they have to have some sort of a response system just in case that kind of stuff happens. Yeah, I believe as long as the police force don't abuse whatever they are given and still put people's welfare safety as far and still put people's safety as first priority, militarization shouldn't be that big of an issue.
On that note, then, actually, that's a very interesting perspective, Nicholas. And I think we might go a little bit more into that when we talk maybe about other forms of violence in the state, but we'll save that topic for later. On that note, we'll pause and take a bit of a break.
That ship out there will be smashed to bits. Use your emergency equipment.
It won't work. Nothing works. It's got to. It's no use. Everything seems to be stuck.
My life's worth a try anyway. Come on, fellas. You can make it.
Just listen to this. Spider-Man saves freighter. You can't tell me the captain couldn't have brought his ship in without the help of that publicity-seeking show-off, Spider-Man!
Don't get caught wasting power. Unplug cell phone, camera, and other battery chargers when charging is complete. Many electronic devices continue to use power even when you are not operating them. The amount of energy consumed by electronics in a year when they were not in use could power Whistler Blackcomb Resorts for 43 years. This Power Smart Play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
Last night, I left the bar. I was thirsty, and I don't drink wine. I was desperate. I needed blood. I turned to the only place I could. The only place that could possibly help me.
Hello, Canadian Blood Services.
Hello. I need some blood. A. Positive or negative, it doesn't matter.
I'm sorry, we're all out of A positive and negative. Would you like some O instead?
No. No, that won't do. Thank you. Good night. Save me. Save yourself. Give blood. Voluntarily.
This message was brought to you courtesy of the Canadian Blood Services and CITR Radio 101.9 FM.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker, the demilitarized, peacekeeping, skeptical show on CITR 101.9 FM. We're going to continue our extended top stories of 2015. We just finished with Gulid's top three. Let's find out what Nicholas thought were the top stories of 2015. So, Nicholas, what is your first top news story of 2015?
My first news topic of 2015 is the UBC president resignation, as well as the freedom of speech scandal at UBC. For those of you who don't know, on July 31st, 2015, UBC president Dr. Arvind Gupta resigned only 1 year into what is supposed to be a five-year term. So Dr. Gupta is a computer scientist, and is also he was a former CEO of a nonprofit organization that worked with government and industry to find student researchers. So he's a very well-established researcher, fundraiser, and one of the reasons why UBC hired him as a president is because of his connection to the industry. So in July 2015, when Dr. Gupta resigned, it came out of nowhere. And then a lot of people were questioning about the reason behind it. And then a week later, UBC professor Jennifer Birdle, who is a researcher in gender and diversity in organizations, posted in her blog saying that Dr. Gupta lost the masculinity contest amongst the leadership at UBC. So soon after Professor Birdle post that on her blog, he received a couple of phone calls, including from the UBC Board of Governors, the chair of the Board of Governors. And the chair basically said Professor Birdle's blog post was grossly embarrassing to the board. And Professor Birdle felt very intimidated by the chair. So there's a few impact on what happened with the all this situation. So even to today, the reason why Dr. Gupta resigned is still unsolved. So they never published the reason why Dr. Gupta has resigned, and many people has been questioning about the UBC's transparency, and of course, the academic freedom was not protected when, especially when Professor Birdo was intimidated by the chair of governor of UBC.
I think that's an interesting thing. I mean, one, the UBC president resignation, of course, you know, brings it home as far as, you know, CITR and all that goes. But because we don't really know why he resigned, I think the area of the idea of freedom of speech is an interesting one, especially freedom of speech at an academic institution like a university. There's been a number of cases south of the border here in Canada that basically, and I'm going to split this off into two parts, but one, that tenured professors should pretty much have free carte blanche to say whatever they want vis-a-vis the actual structure of the university. And the second part of that idea is that in the classrooms, that students and teachers should be free to pretty much discuss any topic out there, provided it's done in a constructive and positive way, even if it is talking about things like racism or sexism or what have you, that may be deemed uncomfortable to some of the students. So this year, Mein Kampf's copyright is expired, and people can now publish it in Germany as much as they want, where they couldn't before. And you might have a class where you'll talk about Mein Kampf and the horrible ideas that are brought in there. And I might suspect that if I was a Jewish person in that class, I may find it offensive and uncomfortable. But the idea that a university should have the freedom to suss out these ideas and with, again, the idea of it being constructive, come to what we would consider to be a positive outcome, that you should be given that free ground. So you mentioned before about, you know, the white student union clubs and that sort of thing, and how, you know, in this, in the context of a university where all thought should be allowed to be given air, even irrespective of what it may be. I'm beginning to ramble on. Who wants to jump in here on that?
I think it's a bit of politics. He should definitely have the platform to talk about these ideas.
What do you think about the idea of there being complete free speech? Do you think there should be limits?
I think there should be some limits in regards to, as long as we're not directing our opinions in a hurtful way towards a very specific group of people. I think with proper, as long as it's in good taste, we should be free with our speech.
So freedom of speech with an asterisk.
Yes, that's exactly it.
So it comes down to, if we're doing a study of racism in the United States and we have a class that talks about the N-word, should everyone in that class feel free to actually use the N-word instead of, as I am right now, self-censoring, saying the N-word, as if anyone doesn't know what the hell I'm talking about?
I think there should be a disclaimer, right? It's a disclaimer, and also permission. Like I have been... I do some acting on the side, and my role, I have to use that word. Like I'm playing a wigger, right? So a very Eminem-like character, and I have to use it. I had to ask the two gentlemen I was with, like, is, I'm about to say this a lot, is it okay? And they're both of African Canadian descent. So they said, yeah, man, obviously this is acting. It's all right. So in certain circumstances, using that word is fine. I mean, even singing it in the car, right? And as long as you've asked, either quote unquote asked permission, or you've made a disclaimer that we will be using this word, but it is for educational purposes only, then I think it's okay.
You actually bring up an interesting twist to it. Although I will correct you that technically, we're all of African descent, just how far back we go. That being said, so I had posed the question in an academic institution, but you have basically said, well, no, under the right circumstances, these words could be used anywhere, provided you get permission, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, for lack of a better word. And it's situational, is what I guess what I mean, and as Gulliver was saying, in good taste. So, you know, you can't use it in a, you can use it in a, you know, follow me here. You can use it in a derogatory situation as long as it's for educational or like movie or TV or play purposes, right? So if it's, you know, this word was said in this way sentence in a classroom, because that's what we're talking about right now, or again, for educational purposes, I think we all know of, you know, American History X and things like that. We don't fault Edward Norton for saying it because it was used for a purpose that is acceptable in our culture.
So Gulliver, just so that we're not doing any white-splaining, your thoughts on that?
Sorry, Gulliver.
My thoughts on the N-word?
Well, so Matt has sort of widened it, because I have basically said that if you're an educational institution, that more or less, and I'll add the caveat, warning, spoiler alert sort of thing, or, you know, there are the, with the caveat that, you know, people are aware of what to expect in the class, that, you know, pretty much anything can be said in a classroom setting. And Matt has basically said, well, you can actually say anything anywhere, provided that A, there's a justification for it, and B, and or B, there is permission given by said person who may be offended.
Yeah, that's, I mean, in a classroom setting, as long as there's some sort of disclaimer or the students involved know how far your free speech is going to go, then that's totally fine, in my opinion. And as far as outside the classroom, it really all depends on context. Yeah.
So, Gulliver, just let's say for you and me, like, we're friends, and yeah. If I asked you beforehand, or even didn't ask you beforehand, if I said my blank,
yeah,
like, how would that go over in your opinion?
That'd be totally fine. I mean, Ramen, not that any of the viewers know who that is, says that all the time to me. It's totally okay.
And if the viewers did know who that is, they would say, oh, that's classic Ramen.
Yes.
Although we'll point out that he is also a person of color, so...
Yeah, that is very true. But he's a... I'm just going to end it there.
Okay. Let's not go too far down the rabbit hole. What were you going to say, Gulliver?
Yeah, I was just going to say it absolutely depends on context and relationships. If you were to say that to someone you barely know... and it wasn't really in an appropriate context, you can definitely disrespect someone. And I know people do have freedom of speech, but I think there should be an asterisk next to that.
So now that we have white-splained and black-splained, Nicholas, you also being someone of not the majority culture in Canada, What would you define as your ethnic heritage?
I define my ethnic heritage as Asian.
Okay. So, again, especially because us white folk are pretty good at denigrating anyone and everyone we've ever come across, what do you think of this whole idea of the use of derogatory or charged words, given the context that we've just talked with Gulliver? Because Gulliver, sure, he has one perspective, but you have a different perspective. Well, you may have a different perspective on it.
I totally agree with Gulliver and Matt. Well, I think as long as the intention is good, and especially for a university, I believe that university is a place where you can explore different topics. You shouldn't feel restricted to whatever you're discussing, as long as you have the intention for being educational purposes. You know, you're not just talk about whatever you want to talk about to make yourself feel better, to disrespect other people. But as long as we keep that in mind, I think it's okay to, you know, explore different topics at educational institutions.
And with that part of it, and perhaps adding a little bit of grease to move us along, what is your second top story of 2015?
Well, my second topic of 2015 is the drop of the oil price. So in the beginning of 2015, the crude oil was over $80 per barrel. And by the end of 2015, it dropped to $35 per barrel. So the price dropped more than half in 2015. So there are a couple of reasons behind this. The key reason is that there's less demand in crude oil in the world. Countries like China and Brazil, their economy start to slow down. They're not growing as fast as before. And also we start having more supplies. You know, Saudi Arabia, UAE refuse to cut down the oil production in order to maintain market share. And Iraq start to pump in more oil. And Iran is expected to become a major exporter again under the new nuclear deal. So, and there's also a few conspiracies in terms of politics. Saudi Arabia and U.S. try to bring down the oil price and in order to hurt Iran and Russia. So that goes back to the topic we talk about, you know, U.S. versus Russia and Cold War 2.0. The impact of the oil price drop is very significant, especially in Canada. So many oil companies started cutting payrolls and start selling the assets. And it's definitely one of the reasons why the economy is starting to slow down. In Canada, there are pros and cons since the oil price dropped and Canada relied heavily on natural resource, the Canadian dollar dropped. So that increased the tourism. So people like to come to Canada, you know, because it's cheaper to come to Canada now because the drop of the Canadian dollar. And also Canadian export increased because it's cheaper to buy Canadian stuff. The gas becomes cheaper. And however, the goods, especially the imported goods, becomes more expensive for Canadians. So there's definitely pros and cons. So I'm just wondering what kind of impact you guys have felt because the oil drop and because the Canadian dollar drop.
I know one of the interesting things that I think have come out of this is that, as you say, you know, we become much more enticing for tourists, for Hollywood North, right? You know, a lot of these things, you know, Canada now becomes very attractive. I think one of the weird things, though, having seen the hollowing out of our manufacturing industry, is that, you know, you're right. Normally, you would expect an increase in exports, and there will obviously be an increase in some exports, but a lot of the manufacturing jobs that used to be in Canada have been exported to other places. And so I don't think that'll be quite the big boon that one would have expected if this was like 30 years ago when you had something like that happen. And it is interesting that everyone warned the previous Harper government about us becoming a petro state, that if the prices ever dropped, that our economy would drop out the bottom, which to a certain degree it has happened. I mean, especially me, I was just noticing today that grapes, I know, what a weird thing to focus on, but grapes. I remember buying grapes like 3-4 months ago for $1.99 on sale, regular price $2.99. Well, they're up to $5 now. And that's because the dollar is so low that when we buy our grapes from California, we pay a huge premium on it now. Now, again, I think if this becomes sort of a longish term thing, that manufacturing will return to Canada to a certain degree, that there will be sort of a bounce. I mean, not everything, the things don't drop forever. In fact, I heard someone talking about how reluctant anyone is to stop a drop in anything, as the no one wants to catch a falling knife, right? Because if you do, it's going to stab you in that. But that eventually, at some point, it will sort of plateau out, and then there'll probably be a slight course correction. Apparently, the Canadian dollar isn't doing nearly as bad when you judge it against something like the euro. But I do think it does show that something like, let's say, Alberta, which is trying to shift its economy away from greenhouse gases, which is probably a topic we'll talk about later, into green energy, that this just helps with all that. Anyone else have any thoughts?
Yeah, I've got a lot of thoughts, especially because I'm going down to Hawaii in a month, so it's gonna be expensive. I think we touched on all of it, right?
What do you guys think about the conspiracy about how, you know, Saudi Arabia refused to cut down the oil production in order to bring down Russia or even Iran?
I think, one, there may be a bit of truth to that, but I think one of the biggest things that I've heard that makes more sense is with the use of fracking and other such techniques, that the you know, the United States, among others, Canada included, that, you know, we have been taking market share away from Saudi Arabia and Qatar and all of them. And that when all this new oil came on board, Saudi Arabia and all of them said, well, okay, we could drop our production and keep the price high, but we would be losing more and more market share. So for them, in classic capitalist sort of mentality, by keeping the price so low, it makes fracking and the oil sands very uneconomic, which means that they'll maintain their market share, even if it's at a lower share, because one of the blessings that Saudi Arabia and them have is to get the oil out for them. It's really cheap. It's like, you know, you just poke a stick in the sand and it just comes gushing out. It's really easy to get a hold of, right? And they may be doing a preemptive thing. As you say, when Iran's oil starts dumping on the market, the price will drop yet again. But if they can make it sort of cost prohibitive, if you are the cheapest guy on the ground, you can keep the price really, really low for longer than almost everyone else, so you drive them out of business. It's the Walmart effect.
I think I'm actually, if I may, like I'm almost glad in a certain way, because it will take our reliance off of the fracking that you were talking about. We are going to have to diversify a little bit more, and I think that's going to happen anyway under the Liberal government. I think that's one of the good things. And I think, you know, I was actually having a conversation with somebody a couple of days ago, but maybe one of the things they're thinking of here is they have to dump this oil in the next 20 years anyway, because more and more we're going to see a shift away from oil. Like, we're going to see more and more green transportation and green practically everything else. So maybe this is a way for them to dump their oil resources and get that money now before they're cut off anyway.
That's very interesting, Matt. So moving us on a little bit. So Nicholas, what was your last top story of 2015?
My last story of 2015 is the end of China's one-child policy and the beginning of the two-child policy. So for those of you who don't know, People's Republic of China was founded in 1949, and Chinese population then doubled within the next 30 years. So by 1980, one-child policy was introduced in China to help population growth. So China claimed that around 400 million births has been prevented because of the policy. And the goal was to eventually reduce the population of China to 700 million in 2080. So the policy was enforced in a few ways. So first of all, there's a monetary bonus to the family that has only one child, and that's exactly what happened to my family as the product of one-child policy myself. And there will be a severe financial punishment for the couples who violated the policy. And in some extreme circumstances, there has been report of forced abortion. And the policy, although it was enforced widely in China, and there's few relaxations to the policy, policy was less enforced in rural area compared to urban centers. And if the couple were both single children themselves, they're allowed to have a second child. And Chinese minorities has always been exempt from this policy. And then if in some provinces, if the first child is disabled or killed in natural disasters such as earthquake, and the second child is allowed. So there's a few impacts of the policy. Number one, of course, population growth decrease. A lot of people have become to realize the problem associated with overpopulation. The second impact is that many single children in China were poorly disciplined and spoiled. And the third impact is what we call a 4-to-1 problem. So one single child has a responsibility of taking care of four grandparents and two parents. So you're putting a lot of a financial burden on the single child. And right now, China is experiencing an aging, top-heavy society, which again put a lot of burden on the newer generation. And there's also huge imbalance in male-to-female ratio. For every 100 female, there is 117 male. So even after China implemented the new two-child policy in October 2015, studies shows that a lot of families are still a little bit hesitant to have a second child because of financial and time commitments. So a study shows that out of 11 million families that are legally allowed to have a larger family, only 1 million had made an application. So that is very interesting, because although China has opened up the policy and many families choose to not have a second child because of, you know, lack of support from the government to raise a second child.
I wonder if that's part of a shifting cultural norm, which China's leadership may or may not have intended. But once it sort of becomes the norm to have one child, even if the legal impediments aren't there anymore, or financial impediments, it's just it's what you do. It's what we've always done. So why would we stop doing what we always do?
Exactly. It kind of become a mental, you know, mentality for young couples in China.
So Matt, what do you think about, you know, China ending this and dooming us all to overpopulation?
Well, you know, it's terrible. Other countries should live up to the standard that we give them and not hold ourselves. I'm actually a very firm believer in a child limit policy. But I think it's hard maintaining a single child policy. And I think a limit of two is a good way to go. Yes, keeping population in check is key, but I think there is a lot of factors that can hinder, and I think this went over all of them. But I think one of them is the benefits of siblings are quite good, and having a pair can be quite beneficial in a child deathmare. No offense, Nicholas. But
you're just not offending Nicholas. You're also offending me, just for reference.
Well, too bad. Good. Do you have siblings?
Yes, I have a brother.
Yeah, perfect. We're obviously better than these two. and I think that it's hard for me to say that this was a bad way to go, because I can't. I don't want to hold them to a standard that we're not holding ourselves to. But I think the most important thing here is I should have invested in, you know, or yeah, I should have taken my money out of the condom industry in China.
So on that note, we're going to call this show to an end. Nicholas, say goodbye.
Bye, guys. Keep on thinking. The world is a wonderful place.
Gulen?
Take care, folks. And remember, different skins, but all the same within.
And Matt?
Good night, folks. Don't forget to be awesome.
We're going to end today's show with a clip of Web Wisdom. This is Big Think and Loris Krauss on Is Xenophobia Inherent in Organized Religion? Let's listen in. And remember, folks, eyes open, minds on.
It's hard to lump religion, which comes in many different forms, shapes, sizes, and viewed many ways by different people, in a single framework. Ultimately, I think religion is a net negative force for humanity, because what it does, at least organized religion around the world, is it implies things about the real world that are just not true, that are in disagreement with the evidence of empirical testing and science. And while they may provide comfort to people, inevitably, whenever you make decisions based on something that's a myth, the decisions lead to bad consequences. Whether you're teaching children or subjugating women. So religion, of course, at various times in human history for individuals provides comfort. It has provided opportunities for groups to sometimes do progressive things. But inevitably, it's based on myth and superstition, based on ideas created by Iron Age peasants who didn't even know the Earth orbited the sun. And ultimately, why we should view that as wisdom is beyond me. The saddest part that's characteristic of everything, including the Quran, and I don't want to label just the Quran in this regard, because I think it's characteristic in the Old Testament and the New Testament and the Abrahamic religions, is the xenophobia that religion introduces. It's us versus them. We are absolutely right because we believe this or because we follow these traditions, and other people are absolutely wrong because they don't. And then the question is, what do you do to the people who are wrong because they're not part of your group? Well, in many cases, you kill them, or you ostracize them, or you send them to hell. No one mentions hell more than Jesus. Supposedly, he was a loving savior. But he uses the word hell more than anyone else in the Bible. So that's the same kind of xenophobia. In fact, it's worse in my mind. As my late friend Christopher Hitchens would say, you know, Saddam Hussein only condemned his victims to violence and death until they died. What about a God who condemns you to eternal pain forever? Well, far worse than a Saddam Hussein in the sky. So I think the kind of xenophobia, the fact that people who don't conform are to be ostracized or killed, is prevalent in every religion, and I can understand it because these religions were based in some sense of preserving order within a tribe. They're all outgrowths of tribal behavior. To preserve order within a tribe, it's always us versus them. Here are rules that define you as a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim. You do those rules and you're distinguishable from the other, and the other is to be swept away. Now, in the current world, I think there's no doubt that right now Islam is a source of more violence than a number of the other organized religions. It's not the unique source of violence, but I think the problem is just one of timing. Islam is 500 years younger than say Christianity. And 500 years ago, Christianity was producing far more violence than Islam ever is today, from the Crusades to the Inquisition. And so it's not surprising that a younger religion, in some sense, is coming through its growing pains in that regard. The problem is we live in a time where there's access to much more destructive forces, so you've got to worry a little bit about that. Ultimately, the real problem, the real difference that I see between Islam and say, Judaism, I mean, the Old Testament is every bit, it's more violent than the Quran. It's full of violence, oppression, genocide, hatred. It's an awful book. And it's amazing that we present it as a moral standard. If you actually read the Bible, it's a disgusting, disgusting document. There's beauty in the Psalms and the poetry of the Psalms, perhaps. But it's every bit as violent, if not more so, than the Quran. The fundamental difference, it seems to me, is that we've learned, even highly religious people take the Bible allegorically. When it says you can stone your children if they disobey you, no one takes that seriously anymore. The difference is that many people take the Quran, every word of the Quran, as not only divine, but literally. And therefore, when it exhorts you to violence, they take that literally. That's not done anymore in the older religions, in the Abrahamic religions. The Bible still says to do those awful things, but people don't take it seriously. In fact, when we talk about religion in general, many people call themselves religious because they think if they don't, they're not good people. There was my friend Richard Dawkins, has his foundation in England, did a poll. It looked after the most recent census in England, which happens to ask what your religious affiliation is. For the first time, only 53% of people said they were Christian, or about that number. But they took the people who listed Christian in the box and said, do you believe in the virgin birth? Do you believe in transubstantiation? Do you believe in and the whole list of things that are sort of standard parts of Christianity? Most of those people said no. And then they were asked, why did you check the tick that said you're Christian? And in the end, they said, we like to think of ourselves as good people. And that's what seems to me the thing that we have to overcome the most, is people recognizing that you can be a good person by accepting reality for what it is and questioning everything, including questioning the existence of God. There's nothing wrong with that. I get letters from kids all the time who say, you know, I'm happy to read your books or see the movie you've just done because it tells me I'm not alone. I'm not a bad person for questioning what my elders or pastor or teacher say. In fact, we should be encouraging our children to question everything. It's part of education.
Scratch. You must first invent the universe. Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars.